Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello, and welcome to If You Love This Planet. Today we're speaking with Dr. Rhys Holter, a conservation biologist at California Lutheran University in Los Angeles. Dr. Rhys Holter is also an author, syndicated science writer, and TV Nature documentary host. He has three university degrees, including a PhD from the University of Melbourne, Australia. Dr. Holter, who likes to be called Dr. Rhys, regularly appears on MSNBC TV, NPR Radio, and Discovery Channel programs to discuss environmental issues. In the late 1980s, Dr. Rhys founded Global Forest Science, an international forest research foundation comprised of over 165 scientists engaged in forest science research and conservation. Dr. Rhys conducts programs to inspire school children to care about ecology, science, and conservation. His most recent book is The Incomparable Honeybee and the Economics of Pollination, published by Rocky Mountain Books in Calgary, Canada. He has also written Wild Weather, The Truth Behind Global Warming, and two children's books. Dr. Rhys is the recipient of the President's Distinguished Service Award from Humboldt State University for his work in conservation biology, and he joins us now on the phone from California. Good evening, Dr. Rhys.
G'day, Alan. How are you?
You'll have to forgive his accent. He spent, a couple of years in Melbourne at the university doing a PhD, and I think he got polluted with Australian language and culture, right?
Absolutely. I've got enlightened, some would say.
You got enlightened. I bet you had a ball while you were at the university, did you?
I sure did. I lived in central Victoria. I actually lived in a community, Kingston, that was about a dozen miles away from the deepest, richest gold strike on planet Earth.
Oh, really? Was that near Ballarat?
Yeah, well, it was about 45, almost 50 kilometers northeast of Ballarat.
And did you find any gold yourself? Did you go looking for it?
No, but I lived on the grounds of the Holy Trinity Church called Kirkside, and I thought I'd landed in heaven. It was absolutely magic.
Well, I'm sure there's still gold in them Nar hills, and one day I might even go out panning for gold. But I bet you drank a lot of beer, did you?
Well, actually, I drank a lot of red wine.
Oh, red
wine. In those days, in the early 90s, it was very inexpensive and very good.
And it's also very good for your heart, red wine. Okay, now look, I've just read your honeybee book, which is absolutely amazing and gorgeous, and I just love it from every perspective, particularly the behaviour of the bees. But we really need to get stuck into this, Dr. Rhys, because as we know, one third of the bees, I think, in California have disappeared due to colony collapse disorder. And the whole of the food economy practically depends upon bees. And I can't believe how many applications bees have to the economy, let alone to nature and to ourselves. So where do we start? First of all, I don't know the difference between a bumblebee and a honeybee.
Okay, well, there are at least 20,000 species of bees on the globe. There may be as many as 40,000.
Wow.
They're predominantly, they are what's called a solitary bee. That is the female. This is a matriarchal society. The female drives it. The female will lay individual eggs usually in individual cavities, and they will cross-pollinate the native plants and go about their lives very quietly. Then there are the bumblebees, which are what I call the Clydesdale. They're much larger, a much larger workhorse of a bee. Their colonies usually are a couple hundred insects strong, females, and they live for the season, and then they die. The only role I will put in here about males is they have only but one role, and that is to inseminate the queen.
And
then there are the stingless.
Go on.
Pardon me. There are the stingless bees that are social and live in larger colonies, and then there's our honeybee that lives in colonies up to 100,000. So we predominantly rely on one species around the earth. It's the Italian strain of the honeybee that does an immense amount of pollinating for the well-being of humankind.
Well, were the Italian honeybees imported from Italy into the United States, or did they exist there anyway?
Yeah, initially, originally, and into Australia, and into Canada,
really?
New Zealand, and Great Britain, etc.
What was wrong with our indigenous bees, both in Australia and in the United States, Dr. Reese?
Well, there was nothing wrong with them per se. It's just that the Italian honeybee was easier and to work with.
Yeah.
And they were able to get into our colonies, the honey hives that we use on an industrial fashion, and they just became in vogue.
Which are the bees that have very few males, about only 200 to 400, to inseminate, whose only function is to inseminate the queen bee? But when they do inseminate her, the penis is extracted from the body and they die in terrible agony.
That would be that's our Italian honeybee. And if the male is fortunate, they get one shot at inseminating the nuptial queen for about 3 seconds. And then their male appendage breaks off. In the queen, and they fall to the ground writhing in pain. And so they have been aptly termed deadbeats because they are moochers, and they really only have one role. And so they get a couple weeks. They're born later in the season to assist when the hive splits. And this is a female, a chick-driven society.
And so the queen then is inseminated, what, with 17 million sperm, is that right? By these males?
Yes, and then that sperm will last her entire lifespan of many, many generations, possibly 4, even 5 or 6 years she can live.
Wow, and so she maintains those sperm inside her body, and then each one inseminates a separate egg. So she obviously makes 17 million eggs in her lifetime, does she?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, she can, under the right circumstances. And when it's so deemed, she will leave her colony and take half the workers with her and set up a new shop and continue on.
So she leaves the old colony because there's not enough room and not enough cells to lay the eggs in?
Yeah, pretty much. It's one of those things in nature when it's time to leave and divide, the process occurs.
So I was fascinated to learn that there are bees from the Arctic Circle and I suppose the Antarctic all the way down to the equator, and there are 20,000 to 40,000 species of bees.
Well, there's approximately 235,000 flowering plants.
Yeah.
And the lion's share of them are pollinated by the bees. The bees were selected about 100 million plus years ago to be nature's main emissary of cross-pollinating.
And before that, we only had ferns and other plants which had no flowers, and 100 million years ago, suddenly the most gorgeous flowers appeared, right?
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, nature, there's something happened, and it was an opportunity for what we call the flowering plants and the trees, which are called properly called angiosperms, like eucalypts. To make their living and proliferate, and the bees were tapped on the shoulder, as it were, and asked to carry the torch, and they've done a remarkable job.
Oh, I've never liked bees, actually, to be quite frank. When I was a little girl, I used to run around in bare feet in Melbourne, and I always got stung by a bee, and it was so painful. And as you say, the sting is separated from the abdomen of the bee and stays in your foot and releasing toxins for about a minute. And, oh, it just used to hurt so much. And Mum used to put a blue bag on my foot. You know, they use blue bags to make the washing white. And she said that helped, but I never thought it helped.
Oh, my. Well, interestingly, that sting, which we call APIS, and the apitherapy, is used very effectively to treat multiple sclerosis and tendonitis and arthritis and a host of other diseases, autoimmune breakdown diseases that require a special kind of pain medicine.
Well,
and 12 countries in Europe already can deem apitherapy as an official drug.
Because it's anti-inflammatory, but I don't understand. I mean, it can't be an analgesic because the pain is so intense. And I don't understand why nature would also put an anti-inflammatory chemical into that sting.
Well, I guess in combination with all of the other organic compounds in the sting, it's certainly enough to ward off any intruder. And it just so happens that for particular human disorders, that it facilitates the transmission along the nerve. So, if you're not ill, of course, it hurts like the dickens. But otherwise, it's a magic, potent medicine and an alternative to some pretty gnarly, harsh pharmaceutical chemicals.
Absolutely. Very gnarly. Okay, now, I don't really know. It's such a vast subject, bees. I was fascinated by their social behavior and also by the pheromones that the queen bee releases, about 180 pheromones. Would you like to describe, Dr. Rees, what a pheromone is exactly, A, and B, what the queen bee's 180 pheromones are used for?
Yeah, the pheromone is a hormone, and it is used in the insect world and otherwise to attract a mate. And the difference between a male and a female, other than their appendage in the bee world, are two very interesting things. The size of the eyes of the males significantly larger to see the queen, but more importantly, their antennae have a couple thousand scent receptors, like 20 times greater than the females, to smell the nuptial queen. Because you see, the queen usually, the new queen usually will only leave the hive once, maybe twice. And the only reason she does that, of course, is to attract the males to collect their sperm so that over her lifetime she can make millions of eggs.
Wow, what a life.
Yeah, well, it's got some pros and cons.
I wouldn't mind being a queen bee.
Well, you know, it's all good, except the real deal here, less in Australia, but almost the rest of the globe, has what's called this colony collapse disorder.
Yeah.
So our colonies are dying, and they're dying for a variety of reasons. In nature, it's very very difficult to tease out what we call the one smoking gun, but it's rather a collision of a number of events, including climate change, including electromagnetic radiation, and including a host of mites, the varroa mite, the Israeli paralysis virus, and my bear bug, and I've said this over and over in the last half a year, are the strength and the toxicity level of the pesticides that we are now manufacturing on planet Earth. As a matter of fact, to give the listeners some idea, we are producing and putting in our biosphere each year the equivalent of filling 100-pound sack of pesticides end-to-end, and they would circumnavigate the equator. That's 5 billion pounds of pesticides each year. Some of those pesticides are of a new group, a very toxic group called neonicotinoids, and they're systemic, which means that they're dunked in the seed or genetically modifying right into the seed these poisons. And when the plant grows, it moves this toxicity to its pollen, to its nectar, and in its fruit. And the bees, I have said this again over, they are the modern-day canary in the coal mine. You used to take the canaries down into the deep the coal shafts, and when they keeled over, it was time to get, the miners knew it was time to get out of the shaft. The bees eat the pollen to make their offspring so that the queen can make the offspring and build brains and build their strong autoimmune system. And they, of course, take the nectar and turn that into honey, because honey is rocket fuel, and that's what enables a little bee to fly 500 miles, again in the English system, but 500 miles is the equivalent of what a forager bee can fly, and after she flies that, her body is worn out. And we're finding that the nectar and the pollen is toxic, and the bees are dying left, right, and center.
Doesn't it make sense, and for any even kindergarten child, to think that if you embed a gene in a plant that produces insecticides, when it flowers, the bees are going to die. Not just the nasty insects that attack the crops, but the bees themselves. Why the hell didn't Monsanto and the other awful corporations making these genetically modified plants, what was in their brains that they didn't understand that?
Well, this is a classic example of where reductionist science paints us right into the corner. You see, the lab tests that they did were in isolation of Mother Nature and the real world. And I gather that their target species of invasive insects were whatever they were, and they certainly accomplished their goal of preventing the target insects from noshing on the crop plants. However, they didn't invite the bees into the reductionist test, and when the bees came into the real world, which is where we all live, out in the great outdoors, they started to fall over left, right, and center. And, you know, the frustrating thing is here in North America, we've seen this bear, the makers of aspirin, tried to pull this off with Gaucho and Poncho, the trade names for the nasty toxic pesticides. And France said, because they lost hundreds of millions of bees and they banned it. They banned this particular a suite of neonicotinoids. They're pounding on the land in North America hundreds of millions of pounds of these neonicotinoids.
Well, are these in the plant themselves accompanying the genetic modification, or are these other pesticides that are applied to the soil and to the plants?
Both, but mostly the neonicotinoids are systemic, so they're genetically either bred in, or the seed is dunked in these poisons for a south plant.
And how does the poison work to kill the bees and the insects, Dr. Reese?
Well, what we know, which is really even more awful, the both ants and bees, so very social insects, are taught when they get sick not to come back to the colony. And so what we're seeing with the bees, for instance, is they are exhibiting symptoms identical to Parkinson's and Alzheimer's disease. And they're shaking themselves to death, they're confused, they're malnourished, they're completely and utterly, they're so confused, they just wander around, fly around aimlessly until they die.
So these compounds, do they block acetylcholine in the brain?
That's exactly right. They alter the plasma lemma, the membrane inside, just on the inside of the cell wall, and they impair the cells, and so the cell to cell communication is a malfunction, and the insect is left in a shocking state.
Well, are you the only one talking about this? I mean, it should come up before Congress, like right now, and there should be laws passed right now to ban these genetically modified plants and using these pesticides. Otherwise, the whole of the American agricultural system that depends upon bees will collapse. And I don't know how much that's going to cost everyone, but I don't like to think in terms of dollars. I like to think in terms of, you know, human life, health, well-being, and ecology.
I agree. And yes, it should be front and center. The agro business here is huge, but we've got an even bigger problem. I've spent the last 37 days, hour after hour each day, covering the Gulf oil spill, and this has been bleeding. They now officially today here admit that it's at least three times the size of the Exxon Valdez in 1989. It's likely that there's 90 million gallons, not 30 million, that have spilled. So it's awful.
And I just read today, of course, this won't be broadcast for several weeks, this interview, but I read today in the New York Times that they were going to inject mud and heavy liquid to block the flow of the oil, but in fact it's increased the flow of the oil, and that has failed. Top Kill has failed.
My God, I'm not aware that it's complete failure. I know that we're waiting with bated breath for the news, but it's got everybody riveted. And my bear bug on this matter is the dispersants, and I've been quoted, and rightfully so, as saying the solution to pollution is not dilution, and they've been spreading the effect, the carcinogenic effects of these polycyclic aromatic compounds that are in oil. They've been passing it through the marine ecosystem, and the awful aspect is we know that the dispersants are toxic to corals. The third biggest coral on the globe is located along the Floridian coast, and the loop current is got some of it and is taking the dispersant toward them. And of course, as you well know, and I hope that some of the listeners realize that some of the most potent medicines on the globe come from our corals. The cone snails that are offering respite 100 times stronger than morphine, the sea squirts that are offering hope for people afflicted with melanoma and breast cancer, and the sponges that from Florida have been treating leukemia since 1969, and of course the blockbuster drug AZT that helps people with AIDS cope, comes from sponges, and on and on. As a matter of fact, in the northeast of Australia, hooray, the soft corals there are the strongest known cancer-fighting medicines ever discovered on planet Earth. Wouldn't you know, every pharmaceutical has a marine lab today.
Well,
Congress is all over the map, and we're very, Dr. Helen, we're very disconnected. We go to the store, we have all our stuff there, we have very little idea, or time, so we say, to discover where it is. I encourage all families, in fact, I beg all families, particularly with children, to only buy organic and to grow your own. You know, even if you live in a flat, get a couple pots and grow your own tomatoes. Grow peppers. We here in America, for instance, apples from Pennsylvania that were recently tested had over 42 different residues of pesticides on one apple skin. Now, look, you don't need to be a physicist. That's just not good. Eating one grain of the equivalent of arsenic or rat poison a day, after X years, your autoimmune system is very likely going to fail. And you are what you eat.
Well, and I also remember when I wrote If You Love This Planet in 1992 that sultanas have, I think, 35 different pesticides in them because they spray them on the grapes. And also, they spray a lot of these pesticides and fungicides and miticides and you name it only days before many of the fruits and vegetables are harvested. And then they wax the outside of the apples and the like, and you can't wash them off. You can't wash them off because they're sealed in this wax-like structure that makes the apples more shiny. I mean, it's sort of self-evident, and yet, and we know the incidence of cancer is rising. And also, to go back to organic food, I want to stress that in Australia we used to have the most beautiful dried apricots. Well, because of globalization, we now get dried apricots from Turkey. And Turkey got a huge fallout from Chernobyl. So radioactive was the tea that the Turkish officials sent the radioactive tea back to Russia just to serve them right because they'd contaminated Turkey. But the radiation in the apricots and everything grown in Turkey will be there for the next at least 600 years. So I went into my organic food shop the other day and there were the Turkish apricots. And I said to my man, are these apricots radioactive? And he looked at me with an expression of surprise and he said, well, they're organic. So the label organic does not necessarily imply safety.
You're right. You are right. And it certainly behooves all of our respective countries to promote it within. And at least here in America, the solace is that organics is very prevalent in every supermarket. And as the scale of economy ramps up, thank goodness the price per unit comes down. And it still is a big problem because it's not all grown locally. But I think we're moving in that direction. And certainly if you compare it today to 10 years ago, I think we've made some good inroads. But we obviously have got a ways.
Well, I think that these huge firms like Monsanto and what's the one that advertises on the McNeil Lehrer show?
Well, there's Dow Chemical, there's DuPont, there's Monsanto, there's
Bayer.
I don't know. Even Cargill is an enormous agro company and privately owned. And yeah, no, they're... It's a multi-billion dollar business.
Yeah, but you know, therefore, how can we allow multi-billion dollar businesses to destroy, you know, much of life as we know it and to increase the incidence of cancer, particularly in humans, but actually in all other species? I mean, it's so upside down, isn't it?
It's one-eyed and it's ridiculous, and irrespective of our beliefs, We all of the time agreeing to disagree, but we better do so because we're near 7 billion strong. They're talking about 2050, we're going to be 10 billion strong. Currently, 3 billion people a day require their daily protein intake from the ocean. And I'm working on a manuscript of detoxifying the ocean, and it is a shocking mess of over-harvesting. And unless we become a sensible species, the report from the United Nations yesterday said that by 2050, all world fisheries will have crashed. So we've got a lot of work ahead of ourselves here.
Well, yeah, but, you know, I always think of what President Jefferson said, an informed democracy will behave in a responsible fashion. But, you know, our democracies, including Australia, are not informed because the media is owned by huge multinational corporations, including one Australian, Rupert Murdoch, and they, although the airwaves are publicly owned, they dominate communication. And the television and the radios are used mostly just to sell these awful products. And so where do we end up except that the whole society is virtually socially engineered and brainwashed to buy all this stuff? And the other thing that fascinates me, Dr. Rees, is that we had this global financial collapse. And then the only way to recover the economy is to sell more, sell more, sell more, sell more, buy more. And we're on a planet with finite resources, and there's only one end to that. There's only one end, and that's the destruction of the ecosphere.
I concur 110%, but I do take solace in the fact that our voice today is loud and clear, and our choice for green and green products has never been louder and clearer. And we each of us can make a significant difference. If we change two habits and tell two people to tell two people, we've got purchase power in our pockets. And if we don't like the government, we can all tell our mates, and we can vote these governments out. And people are beginning to listen, and we I'm an inveterate optimist, and I believe the only thing we as a species were designed to was that for every problem, there are at least three solutions, and we are a problem-solving species. And take umbrage, because nature's blueprint right in front of us is the exquisite, flawless plan. There is no waste in nature, and the more that we mimic millions of inventions in front of us, the better off we are. I remind people that Velcro came from the cocklebur little seed. I remind people that the athletes, the Aussies who did the nation so proud in China in the swimming pool in their Speedo suits, those Speedo suits mimic shark skin and they repel water and are wonderful paint. The quick-drying paints come from the sea life, from clams and mollusks, and some of the best glues come from the holdfasts and barnacles at the bottom of the sea. There are thousands of great inventions that are just waiting for our children who've got huge brains and can figure this out, how we all are going to live here, because unless a couple people are going to go to Mars and start a whole new atmosphere and create soil and water, this is our home and we got to protect it.
I just love your passion. I just love it. You should make a film like the one Al Gore is, because you've got 10 times more passion than Al, although he did a good job.
Well, it's okay. I'm not on my watch. Are we going to go down? We're going to highlight all the great things, and there are so many great things. And, you know, kids get it. I mean, we've got to focus our energy on the youth of today. And I fervently believe because they are smarter, they need to be fed, and they need to be shown how we can change and how we are changing, because that's the only hope we have.
Yeah, well, we can change too, you know, and our brains are still big. And even though I'm 70, what am I, nearly 72, and my brain's deteriorating a bit, there's still a lot of intellectual capacity there to do good. So we mustn't exclude the older, wiser generation either, Dr. Rees.
No, I know that. I know that. They're good value. But it's the kids. They need to be inspired. And all of these electronic gadgets are wonderful, but we are a low octane species, a hunter, a gatherer, nuts and fruit to occasionally eat meat, and somehow we've become a sedentary, agrarian, saturated fat beast. And you wonder why we're having all these illnesses? I don't. And so we've got to empower the kids to get outside and see nature and ask these questions. And I guess that's why we work at universities, because we get to see these young brains and help them be directed into the future, our future.
Yeah, well, and also, you know, when I was a kid, there was no television and no cell phones and hardly any aeroplanes. And I grew up just wandering the meadows and picking blackberries in the sort of rubbish dump and trying to derail trams with big stones and going on the golf courses and climbing trees and making huts and lying on my tummy watching the ants and the little tiny wildflowers. And hence I just absolutely loved nature. And I remember when I was about, I don't know, 3 months old, my mother used to put me out in the pram under the silver birch, and I can remember the sounds of those birds and watching the glittering leaves in the sun, and that's just part of my psyche.
Yeah, and Australia has some of the most magic and exquisite and mellifluous and melodious birds on the globe. When I worked up in the Victorian Alps for 3 years, every month, month I would go for a week and live up in the high country with the snow gums, the cockies and the maggies and the chuffs. I really did think I had landed in heaven, and on my way up the mountain I would pass through the woolly butts and the peppermint group, and that smell will live in every one of my cells until I return there, because it really is eye-opening. And I mean, Australia is such a magic place because there's over 700 kinds of eucalypts. I mean, you talk about speciation. It is phenomenal. And that, of course, some live up in the snow in a mostly arid, warm continent is highly intriguing, and their role to hold the little bit of snow in the high country and moderate it in the springtime to feed into the streams, obviously, as climate change grips us, is of paramount importance. And will they be able to live? They're painted and living on the edge of a warm climate, and some of them, by that very virtue, may be pushed over the edge.
They're so beautiful, those snow gums. What exact research did you do, Dr. Rees, with the roots of the snow gums that live in the snow?
Yeah, look, I was trying to figure out how they were adapted to the cool, near freezing soil temperatures, and we looked at some amino acids, and we looked at some other cryoprotectants, and my goodness, for the first time, there's about 80,000 kinds of trees around the globe, and in the southern hemisphere, my work with the snow gums was the first, and we call that in Latin an a priori, to show that the tree roots actually grow more during the night than the day.
Huh.
We
humans.
Showed that they grow under snow. They elongate in the spring and in the late autumn when the top of the tree is completely shut down, and all sorts of fascinating esoteric things.
Okay, so look, we'll move from snow gums now and to I want you to describe to the audience, Dr. Rees, the medicinal effects and otherwise of honey?
Honey is a remarkable substance, you're right. It, I mean, first of all, it has a byproduct from when the bee makes the honey is hydrogen peroxide. And so if you get a cut, for instance, and you put a little dollop of honey on the cut, it will completely and utterly keep it clean and healthy. As a matter of fact, I understand there are bandages in both Australia and elsewhere that are laced with honey. So the topical application of honey is antiseptic, it's antiviral, it's antibacterial, and
it antifungal
for thousands of years. Pardon me?
Is it antifungal?
And antifungal, that's right. So we've got it. We've got the whole suite of medicinal values to apply it topically, and it is a wonderful substance that is loaded with B1, B3, B6, and vitamin E, C, potassium,
A,
calcium,
vitamin A,
manganese, and it's so wonderful. It actually mimics our blood and our blood serum. So it's high in calories, it's high caloric, and it can be taken, and it is a wonderful source of energy for humans. People who suffer from diabetes, and there are two known honeys, the Manuka honey from New Zealand and the Tupelo honey from Florida, that are very low on the glycemic index, which means that people with diabetes can take it. It's also, some of my colleagues have done work over the years to show that a couple of teaspoons of honey before you go to bed is a wonderful way to sleep soundly and restfully throughout the night. You realize that our liver can store about 8 hours worth of glycogen if we eat our evening dinner or tea around 6 or 7 at night. Around 3 in the morning, we run out of glycogen, and our brain then releases the stress cortisol, a stress hormone, which rips around the body and looks for muscles to make glycogen. But in the meantime, it elevates the heart, and it awakens us. If you take a couple teaspoons of honey before you go to bed, you're very likely to sleep throughout the night. Children over the age of 2 can take a couple teaspoons. It helps their growth plate expand and helps them grow. So there's a number of strong medicinal values for honey.
Okay, now let's move on to beeswax. What is beeswax used? Oh, first of all, I just would like to say that apparently, when Alexander the Great was killed, his body was sent back in a coffin full of honey, which was used to preserve him, right?
Yeah.
Wow.
And we know that honey seals. It's the only known substance on the globe that, when sealed, can last for thousands of years, because the pharaohs had sealed honey next to their tombs. And when the seal was removed, the honey was edible.
Fancy that. And I was going to ask you one more question, and it slipped my mind about honey, which was very important. But let's move on to the use of beeswax and what that contains, medicinal properties and otherwise.
Yeah, well, the beeswax is utilized, 44 million pounds of it each year.
Good God.
Around the globe.
Yeah.
In a wonderful, from candles to the mouthpieces of the didgeridoos, to sealing the screw holes on the slate for our pool tables. And, of course, it makes dental impressions and some of the finest waxes for furniture and cars. And the beeswax is a wonderful. If you burn a beeswax candle, it has such a terrific scent. And the beeswax is made by the bee from its abdomen, the hive, there can be as many as 77,000 honeycombs in a hive, and it takes bees 66,000 bee hours to make that. Now, here's a very interesting factoid. The honeycomb structure, the six-sided honeycomb structure, is in fact one of nature's most perfect pieces of architecture, because 2 pounds of wax in a hive can hold 20 pounds of honey. And that same principle has been used, translated into the wing of every aircraft on planet Earth. And they have that six-sided honeycomb structure. And of course, the wings carry, that's the fuselage, where the plane carries its fuel.
Absolutely fascinating. So, do we have colony collapse disorder in Australia, Dr. Rees?
There are some illnesses in the land down under, but nothing like we have seen in Western Europe or in North America or in parts of Asia. And we as a result, Australia exports queen bees like the dickens.
Oh, really?
Unless you're caught in stock, because if it wasn't for Aussie, we really, really would be in a bad way here.
How do you export a queen bee in an aeroplane?
You put her in a little box and you give her a good hug and a kiss, and they come over, and they of course have been scrutinized in the last while, because in our earnest attempt to go global with everything, including the honeybee, there was some concern that importing the honeybees from Australia may have been the source, but that was easily disproved a couple years ago, and Australia really is buoying up planet Earth, because in America, you know, every third bite on our dinner plate comes from the humble honeybee. And the bees also in America are responsible for growing all of the cotton and the alfalfa and clover that goes into the mighty beef and dairy industries. There's medicine, there's wax, and there's a couple hundred million pounds of honey that is a byproduct of this wonderful pollinization process.
Well, let's talk about cotton, because I was asked years ago to address the Australian Cotton Growers Association about the sort of pesticides, and I got a terrible shock, because cotton is grown with the most enormous quantities of carcinogenic, cell-killing pesticides. And then I found out that cottonseed oil is used for margarine, and cookies, in candies, in the whole thing. And, you know, so through cotton, not only is the cotton that we wear on our bodies, and particularly you have to wash cotton garments before you put your baby in them because they have these pesticides, but the food we're eating, much of it is cottonseed oil, and that's full of pesticides too, which, of course, is going to aggravate the killing of the bees.
Yeah, no, it's major, major problem here. There's over 1,800 massive-sized farms in America. It does $27 billion in commerce. And not only are they a lot of pesticides applied, the cotton plant is very hard on the soil.
Yeah.
It extracts all kinds of minerals and supplements on the soil, and there's quite a movement afoot to buy and create organic cotton. We know how to do it. It's just a wee bit more expensive, but again, once the demand and the scale of economy is ramped up, the price per unit comes down. And I maintain this: it's not a matter of it's too expensive. We cannot afford
not
to continue down the path that we are headed, because we're beating the dickens out of the soil. You know, a gram of a healthy soil, get this, a gram of healthy soil can have trillions of of nature's organisms, microorganisms, and all kinds of life, we know that if we beat it down with all of these liquid fertilizers and pesticides and herbicides and miticides and fungicides, that gram will go from trillions down to a couple million.
Huh.
And we also know how wonderful and powerful nature is, that a healthy soil confers a healthy autoimmune system to a plant, and therefore the plant is able to fend off all of these pests that otherwise would knock it down. So we know this, and we have a terrific soil food web that inoculates the soil with what's called a compost tea and can rebuild the soil. The most important thing we have on planet Earth, other than clean air and fresh water, is the soil.
Soil, yes.
And we know how to feed soil and how to make it strong. I am so elated that we, even at a grassroots level, understand this, because that is the way of the future. It's the only way.
Yes, I have a vegetable garden, which I have to protect with a huge mesh cage, because the bowerbirds and other birds eat the fruit, and also the wallabies, small kangaroos, which live in my garden, hop in and eat everything. But I've got a compost bin, and every single bit of organic waste goes into the compost bin. I've got a worm farm, so I've got lots and lots of worms eating all my compost, and I've put that on my garden, and I can't believe the growth of the lettuces, the silver beet, the broad beans, the peas. It's unbelievable. And that's,
well, there's no waste in nature, Dr. Helen. And that's, you know, we look at this as the food and the life pyramid, and at every level, everybody eats. There's no unemployment. Everybody gets something, and no waste.
Well, that's how we used to live, hunters and gatherers, you said, and then and tending the soil. I mean, we all used to be out, you know, 8 hours a day growing our crops and carting them and grinding the wheat and stuff. Now, it was hard work, but now we've also got antibiotics and modern medicine to keep us alive. We, as you said, unless we're in touch with the soil and the plants and the birds and the bees and the worms, we don't understand in the depth of our souls what we have to preserve and also how much we need to love it, because if we love it, we will preserve it.
Exactly right. And that gets back to my original point. If you want to impact change, we start with the children very young.
Yeah.
I've just got a new book out. My childhood imaginary friend, Bruni, is having his second adventure in the mysteries of the Redwood Forest. You can't start children young enough in biology. And here's the thing, they get it. Kids love to go and play in the mud. They love to go to the beach. They love to be outside and investigate. It's always, you know, it's the adult that's saying, oh, don't touch that.
Oh,
that's
yes,
slimy or gooey or mucky. I love that stuff. My kids love that stuff, you know. And so that's how, you know, and I'm very optimistic that our youth want this, need this, will embrace this, and when the baton is firmly planted in their hands, they will move it in the right direction.
Yes.
And they will look back at some of these generations and go, you people just didn't get it, did you?
And this crazy American allergy to germs, you know, and bacteria, and everything's got antibacterial stuff, and that's bad because you don't build up your immune system. I mean, my oldest grandson, who was, when he was a baby, used to sit on the beach and eat sand by the handfuls because it was nice and salty. And the other anecdote I'd like to end with is that I knew a professor of biology at a university in New York, and he took his students who were adolescents, or they were college students, to a farm to see where milk comes from. And they didn't know. They thought it came in big plastic bottles. And when the cows urinated and defecated, the girls fainted.
Oh, you're joking.
No, that was a true story.
Oh, my. Well, you know, that's step one, is you've got to understand where it comes from. Get to the source.
Yep.
And then we're able to move on.
That's right. Well, look, I think we've run out of time, Dr. Rees. It's been absolutely fascinating. I mean, I'm a biologist fundamentally like you are, and I find all this just fascinating. In fact, I guess that's my religion. I'm a pantheist. I worship nature and have, I guess, since I was a very tiny baby. And obviously you do too, and we all must do that. It's so beautiful.
Yes, and from our end, we want to congratulate you for all your work that you've done to enlighten people of the dangers of this nuclear power and the follies of believing that we have to go back in time.
Yeah.
We need to move forward in time, and you get it, and your listeners get it, and God bless all of you.
Yes, and I just remembered the last question I had about honey. If you put a nuclear weapon in honey or molasses, you totally disable it. So we can use honey to eradicate the world of nuclear weapons.
Oh,
isn't that amazing?
Wonderful. And I'll leave you with one last story. You know, our bees are doing two wonderful things. They're frontline detecting tuberculosis, heart disease, and diabetes. When people breathe into a clear glass container,
yeah,
the bees are able to smell the disease on our breath and alert doctors. And honeybees have also been trained to sniff and collect TNT, the residue from landmines. There are between 80 and 110 million landmines spread around in 70 countries that are maiming tens of thousands of children each year, and our wonderful honeybees are helping to detect where those landmines are so that we can protect our children.
So the honeybees can help eradicate landmines and to definitely abolish nuclear weapons, eradicate nuclear weapons. So here's for the honeybee.
Cheers. Thank you so very much for having me on your show.
Thank you, Dr. Rees. Bye-bye.
Cheerio.
My guest today was Dr. Rees Halter, an author, a syndicated science writer, and a TV nature documentary host. His most recent book, The Incomparable Honeybee and the Economics of Pollination, was published by Rocky Mountain Books in Canada. He is the recipient of the President's Distinguished Service Award from Humboldt State University for his work in conservation biology, and he's an absolutely fascinating biologist, as you've heard. Thank you for listening to us today, and we'll be back with you next week on If You Love This Planet.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.